Sure is. With our guest tonight, Lauren Weinstein, we're talking about issues, privacy issues. I'm amazed in my fast blasting here that it's running about 50-50. 50% of you think that we should do whatever it takes to fight and combat terrorism. And the other 50% simply say, nope, we need to follow the law no matter what. So we'll be back in a moment. We'll continue this discussion. Later on next hour, we'll open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. Lauren Weinstein, our guest. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Are you surprised that it's running about 50-50, Lauren, with regards to at all costs, do whatever you have to do to get terrorism?
No, it's about where I'd expect it to be. This country is so evenly split on almost all topics. And, of course, when you discuss this kind of topic, it automatically has political undertones to it, because it becomes a, you know, are you for the president or an against the president sort of question,
right? Exactly. So in this case, if it is, you know what, I don't know if he broke the law in this particular case. He claims that he thought he had the right to do it. Congress, some members say, no, that wasn't our intent. It's probably not going to go much further than that, is it?
Well, they'll hold hearings. There'll be closed hearings where probably all the real meat will be, and then there'll be the open hearings where there'll be posturing by everybody involved. I think what might be more interesting is what happens in these court cases where these defense attorneys are going to try to find out whether information from potentially illegal wiretaps were used in court cases, because that's when it really, really gets into a gooey situation very fast.
And then to see if the courts then, if it's proven that they were obtained that way, illegally, if the courts throw them out or not.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key questions, though, is the right way to do this, really, is to ask for the authority. That avoids so many problems. If you need a more rapid way, if you want to do traffic analysis, if you want to jump around from number to number within certain closed communities to try to figure out who's doing what in ways that aren't authorized under the current FISA statutes, for example, then you go to Congress and you do that. You don't put yourself into a situation, you'd hope, where the exposure of something like this is going to cause so many problems for everyone involved, including your own agenda. It's really helpful. You know, they say sunlight is the best disinfectant, and oddly enough, even in intelligence issues, sometimes trying to keep things too secret can result in it blowing up in your face, and then no one is the better.
Talk about these cameras that we find now on traffic lights and signals all around this country. States are passing them for two reasons. One, they don't have enough budget for police officers, so it's easier and cheaper to put some camera up there.
Yeah. But
is that an invasion of our privacy?
Well, you're talking specifically about red light cameras?
Yes.
Yeah. That's really not a privacy issue per se. It's more interesting in terms of is it what it purports to be question. You said it just now. You mentioned not having enough police officers, and what that really means is money. And there's a real issue with whether or not, in many cases, these red light cameras haven't been situated in such a way, and with yellow light timing in such a way, which is a very critical part of the equation, to be revenue enhancement tools rather than safety tools. And there's been a lot of back and forth on this. As you probably know, some areas that previously had red light cameras have now removed them, because it began to appear that they were not fulfilling their original purpose, even though they were bringing money into the treasury. In California, they have to have signs up on the intersections where those red light cameras are in use. But in some parts of the country, not only are there red light cameras, but there's also automated speeding trap systems too. I'm not using trap in a prerogative sense, but you know that's what it is to most people.
In California, where are the signs posted? Are they by the camera, or do they give you a little forethought that it's coming?
It's supposed to be you know so many feet in front of the intersection with a little symbol of a red, yellow, green traffic light, and I think it says controlled intersection is the typical phrase on there. Somehow those often end up behind bushes and things. It's funny how that happened. But it really does appear in a lot of cases. There are some intersections where there were safety concerns, but boy, when you look at the numbers on these things, it does seem like somebody somewhere figured out that if you put it on this particular intersection and you shorten the yellow light a little bit, they're not supposed to do that. The yellow light is supposed to be managed in a fair way, but every little tweak you make of the system brings in N more dollars, and I think that has a lot of people kind of steaming under the collar.
I haven't seen the numbers, but I wonder what some major cities bring in traffic tickets and fines and violations.
Yeah, I don't know the number offhand, but it's not trivial. It is decidedly not trivial.
I would guess that it pays a pretty good sum of a police department's budget, would think.
Yeah, I guess it's going to probably be a different kind of thing in a big city versus a small community in terms of the ratio on these things. But to the extent that these systems can be automated, there's always a lot of incentive to do it. But of course, the red light cameras are just one aspect of video systems. It's probably at the bottom of the list when it comes to privacy issues. What's of more concern is often when money is being spent for putting cameras in more general surveillance modes, where it starts to feel like you're being followed all the time by a policeman, and that brings up all kinds of other issues.
Let's talk about that if we can, Lauren. Where might these cameras be situated?
Well, they're pretty much everywhere now in a lot of cities in terms of the kinds of places they can be. Some of them are the traditional kinds of cameras that are very obvious because they're the big metal units with the pan and tilt systems and all of that. But of course, the technology has been advancing rather rapidly in this area, and you can now have tiny little cameras that don't even appear to be cameras. And the usual argument that's made in favor of these by law enforcement, and I've heard this so many times that whenever I hear it, I start to feel a little bit queasy, is that you have no expectation of privacy in public places. This is the line that everybody uses. And it's an unfortunate way of looking at it, because it seems to suggest that if the technology existed to follow you everywhere you went from the moment you left your door to the moment you got to your destination, and to record that all the time and to store it and then go back and look at it later or whatever, there'd be no problem with that. And yet, if that was being done by, and the example I use is a slimy little guy in a raincoat with a clipboard, who as soon as you left your house, he started trailing you, driving a Columbo-type car or something,
yeah,
right?
You can't get away from him.
And wherever you go, he's following you, and he's carrying a little camera, and every time you look in a window, he goes snap, and when you talk on your cell phone, he starts scribbling on the manila pad and all that. And if you had a million of those guys following a million people, I don't think most citizens would really be comfortable with that. And yet the kind of surveillance networks, the video surveillance networks that are being gradually implemented, really amount to the same thing in a technological way. And if you want an example of where it can really go to the ultimate, all you have to do is go to England, which is rapidly becoming the 1984.
Yes.
It's absolutely... absolutely amazing what's going on over there now, not only in terms of video surveillance, which has become vast, but as you may know, they actually are starting to track license plates of cars. These systems have gotten so good now that they can watch the license plates. They started out using it only for congestion control into London,
right?
So that they could charge people when they entered the city center a fee for coming into London. But now there's a big push to extend that and basically watch people's license plates everywhere. And then there's also pushes for GPS, for global positioning system, black boxes to be installed in cars for other kinds of tracking. Usually there's some ostensibly benign reason for this. You know, someone will say, well, we need the GPS system in the car so that we can do more precise taxation of road usage. This has been suggested here in the U.S. too. But then you get into the problem of what else can it be used for? We have a problem with that right now when it comes just with the kind of simplistic black boxes that are in vehicles now. A lot of people don't know that the cars that they're driving around in, if they're at all recent, have often not very sophisticated, but recording capabilities that record an awful lot of information about what happens in an accident or how you brake or how fast you've gone recently and all these kinds of things. And the fact that that exists isn't necessarily the problem. The problem is that we don't have laws and rules usually to control how that information is used. So it ends up going to the insurance company. It ends up going here and there. And that's when, again, the abuse starts to creep in because the technology has gotten ahead of the laws and the way we're going to use them.
Well, in Britain, for example, why have they gone crazy with all these cameras?
It's a combination of the revenue issue for getting into the city and the natural extension of the anti-terrorism concerns. Because after all, Britain, you know, has a much longer history of terrorist attacks than we do here.
Sure.
They have a long history that went back with the IRA and such. So there was sort of a natural affinity for these kinds of systems. But this time around, it has been controversial. The new law that they were attempting to pass there that had a number of quite dramatic measures in it actually got pushed back by the House of Lords, I think it was. So, which is an unusual kind of event. So it's sort of a harbinger of what can come for us, I think. Is that the kind of world we want to live in? That's the question we ultimately have to ask ourselves. If we wanted to be as secure as we could be, even theoretically from terrorists and from criminals and from child molesters and all these things, there are things we could do. We could have cameras in every room of every house. Technically, that will become possible.
Right.
We could record everything, everywhere you go, everything you do in your home. And the argument could be made that if you're a law-abiding citizen, why do you care?
Why do you care?
And then one has to say, well, maybe the concept of privacy is obsolete in that kind of environment. Maybe it's just an obsolete term. Maybe 100 years from now, or maybe far less, if you look it up in a dictionary, it'll have that little archaic next to it, no longer used. But that's not the kind of world I want to live in.
Well, you know, it's somebody we talk about Hollywood and the kinds of movies they've pumped out. I always will remember the movies where they've got this big screen in the middle of some city, and they've got this large headshot of this individual who's constantly talking to them 24/7, you know, and everybody's monitored, everybody's being watched. You can't do anything wrong. And if you, you know, like a Stepford Wife, if you just move along in your own little world, you'll be okay, but you can't do anything. You can't think badly about anything. You can't question anything. You're like a robot person.
And it's worth remembering that those kinds of worlds that we see in those science fiction movies and stuff, science fiction has a tendency of being predictive more often than we might like. And it's not always obvious when the film is made, but, you know, years down the line or decades down the line, you find out that the people who were writing these things were pretty good in the prediction business, even if they were trying to predict at the moment themselves. But those kinds of worlds, the Stepford world, the controlled world, the 1984 kind of world, you wouldn't get there all at once. It's not like one day you wake up and Big Brother is in control. It has to happen very gradually, and it will normally happen with the agreement of most people, because each of those little individual steps will be taken with some purported good cause attached to it. This will provide this safety benefit. This will provide this benefit. You're only giving up a little bit of freedom, a little bit of freedom, a little bit of freedom. But sooner or later, you look in the mirror, and strip by strip, your clothes have been removed, and you're standing there naked.
Are the safety benefits real, or were they made up in order to do what is being done?
I tend to think that most of the time, and of course, there's always going to be bad players in any endeavor, but I think that most of the time, the motives of the people who do these things are good motives. I think that at the time that these ideas are being proposed, they honestly feel that this is a good thing for society. But you have to go the next step. You have to go beyond what seems good at the moment to what happens when this is abused, what happens when this is used in a way you didn't intend, what happens when a new government some years down the line uses it in a way you hadn't planned for, or what's going to happen when the technology expands its powers by 100 times or 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times. And that's harder to do. It's harder to make those judgments. And as a society, we kind of have to hold people's feet to the fire to say, hey, we have to look at this now, because afterwards it's too late.
Why don't those creators of these issues now look down the road? How come they're so short-sighted?
Primarily, I think, because our whole system, and this is really a global thing, is based on immediate gratification, if you want to call it that. We don't want to worry much about 10 years down the line or 5 years down the line. In fact, our political systems are oriented in such a way as to make sure that we tend to think in very short terms.
We don't have the Chinese mentality, for example, of waiting. You're right. We want everything today.
And if you're going to do it, if you're going to think in those short time intervals, then there's just no place for imagining what could go wrong 5 years from now or 20 years from now, and then you're looking back and you can't change the past. So it's a very difficult situation, and really the only hope we have is that enough people will become concerned about these various aspects to put pressure on their elected representatives to say, hey, stop for a moment and let's think this through.
I don't think anybody has problems of cameras being in stores and banks. ATM machines record your face every time you go in there to make a deposit or a withdrawal. It's some of these other issues, I think, that would get people really upset, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, or another example is when information is collected for one purpose that's used for something else. So maybe your face is gathered for at an ATM machine, but then it ends up being used in other ways for other purposes. Maybe in a face recognition system, so the next time you go into some other store, it knows you by name, reports to your insurance company that you bought a medication that they didn't know about. I mean, these are all things that sound like science fiction but are rapidly becoming reality, because all the little bits and pieces needed for that kind of pervasive surveillance society, that kind of pervasive environment, are really falling into place right now. And the only protection we have from that kind of what I call it data creep, when you have data for one thing and it creeps into other things because there's nothing to stop it. The only protection you have is laws that look far enough ahead to say, hey, here is an acceptable use, here is an unacceptable use. But again, the people who build these systems and promote these systems, they're in the business of talking about the good parts, not the ways that things can go wrong.
And I don't see it slowing down, do you?
No.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Lauren Weinstein, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the campaign continues, not for long. We need your help getting very close to the goal, sponsoring a number of children for Children International this holiday season. $18 a month is the commitment they ask for 1 year, 60 cents a day, to provide a needy child with food, clothing, health care, and education. How do you do that? A couple ways. The simple way is pick up the phone, 1-800-869-9863. That's 1-800-869-9863. Or go to the coasttocoastam.com website. You can do that right now. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a yellow flashing banner. Click that. You can sponsor a child. And once we reach our goal, everybody will be delighted. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, Lauren. The Benjamin Franklin period of his time talked about privacy, saying if we were prepared to give up rights, we're going to lose everything, basically, that privacy is so important in a society.
Yeah, it was. I think the line was actually even more specific than that. It was like, he who is willing to give up privacy for security gets, neither. But this does show us, though, that the issue was certainly present back then and is not something new to us.
Well, and he was so right on with that, too. He really was. So what are the chances of you experimenting and getting a chip implanted in you and we can monitor you?
That's in the when hell freezes over category.
Won't happen. Now, was it Tommy Thompson? Said that he was going to get a chip. He was on the board. He still is, I guess, on the board of Applied Digital, and he has not gotten that chip yet. Did you hear about that story?
Yeah, I hear he just hasn't gotten around to it yet. You'd think he'd be able to find a way to get over to the chip injection center, but he hasn't done it yet. I wonder why.
Now, I had a story before the program even started about a cat in England that had been lost for 6 years. But because of a chip embedded in the little thing, they were able to get back to its rightful owner 6 years later, but they still got it back to her.
Yeah.
I guess on the face of it, that sounds okay, doesn't it?
Definitely. I'm a cat lover anyway, so anything that gets people's cats back to them is all right by me. But, of course, on the other hand, cats tend not to have a lot of personal information that can be abused by ID-related problems, at least most cats that I know. So the parallel kind of breaks down after a while there.
This is moving at a very fast clip, though, and I'm not sure it can slow down.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you have to worry about not only about the chips being implanted, but the chips being sort of everywhere else where you least expect it. There's an interesting controversy now about U.S. passports. Have you heard about this one?
Another one? No. Go ahead. Well, tell me.
Yeah, they will be implanting. They're probably starting right about now or very soon. They'll be implanting RFID chips. You guys talk about RFID all the time
sure.
on the show, of course. In all U.S. issued passports. The reason is that way when you go through a port of entry, it can just be scanned without having to. Not have to be physically touched per se, but it can be read electronically rather than somebody just looking at it and trying to decide whether or not it's legitimate just on the face of visual inspection. The thing is that the RFID system, of course, can be read by other things too, rather than just the official reader at the customs point. And there was a big controversy about how that was going to be controlled, because the kinds of information that could be read out of the RFID chip on a passport could potentially be extremely valuable to people that are involved in identity fraud and such.
So,
at the moment, the word is that the chip would only hold the same information that's on the face of the passport.
Same thing, right.
But the chip is being specifically engineered in such a way that it could hold a lot more. And you wouldn't necessarily know when it was being added. So what they finally decided to do was they were going to put what basically amounts to aluminum foil, more or less, in the front and back covers, and to try to prevent it from being readable when it's closed. But it's even worse than that, because the particular kind of RFID chip they used has very weak very weak encryption. So while it could have been made a lot stronger, the for cost reasons or whatever,
yeah,
the decision was made that security had to take precedence over privacy in this case.
And they're going ahead with this.
Oh, yeah. It's a done deal.
Oh, my. I mean, is it fail-proof in that? Would it, if someone was going to make a fraudulent passport, do you think they'd get around this problem?
Well,
would they be able to put in a phony chip or something like that?
I think with enough effort, the answer would be yes. Because since the encryption system is relatively weak compared with what's available, by definition, those weaker encryption systems are easier to crack. Now, whether it's worth the effort for someone doing identity fraud to do that is one thing. But on the other hand, if you were a potential terrorist with a large organization behind you and you wanted to do a fraudulent passport or clone someone else's passport, for example, that might be something that would be something that they'd want to think about doing. And in that case, you have to worry about the weaknesses actually undermining security.
See, I think the day is going to pop up where people will have chips in their arms or wherever they put them on their body. And there goes the currency. There goes the need for a plastic card to stick into your ATM machine. All you do is wave your arm. And can you imagine the horror of people when they get robbed? It's not going to be for their wallets anymore. It's going to be for their arms. I'm serious.
Oh, yeah. Well, in fact, there's already been scenarios of people, with fingerprint-based systems where there's this issue of the fingerprint being taken with the finger having been removed from the hand as a potential issue.
Oh, my God.
This actually relates to broader problems of biometrics, right? I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, I would. That fascinates me.
But biometrics is that whole area of trying to use things that are intrinsic to a person's body for identification purposes. With fingerprints is the one we most think of. Retinal prints is another. Iris scans is yet another. There's even work being done on things. Face recognition is actually a form of biometrics. There's even work done on gait recognition, trying to recognize someone from the exact way that they walk and things like that. But with most of these systems, particularly the ones involving, I think the fingerprint one is one of my favorites, because with all the work that's been put into fingerprint scanning systems, there's this professor somewhere, I don't remember where he is right now, but he's been able to basically subvert most of these systems in tests by using, he started with gummy bears.
Oh, my God.
And then he worked out some more sophisticated systems using materials that cost maybe $5 instead of $1. But it turns out almost all these systems were easily defeated, even if they were looking for body warmth and things like that. That was all easy to do. Now, iris scans and things are tougher. But one of the things is, what do you do when your biometric information is compromised? In other words, if someone does get a copy of your iris scan and starts to use it in a bad way, what do you do moving forward from there? It's not like changing your password. It's kind of hard to get a new iris to change it. So one of the interesting things about biometrics is that they're not changeable. You're stuck with them, and if the underlying database that's related to them becomes contaminated, in essence, you've still got to use that same biometric, and that can kind of leave you out in the cold.
Well, it's hard enough to fix your credit report and things like that when somebody steals your identity and starts playing around. This could make it even worse.
Yeah, but it's the kind of thing where, again, people are sold on the convenience. You were saying, one day people will probably have chips implanted, everybody. And I think that's a potentially real scenario. I don't think it's 5 years away. But I think that within a generation or two generations or whatever, that's the kind of thing that is certainly within the realm of possibility, and it'll be sold to people on a basis of doing good. I think what'll probably happen though is that we'll start with the groups of people that we don't like the most, right? That would be the easiest way to bring something like this into society. You start with prisoners. Child molesters, you were talking about, that's an obvious group that not very many people like.
So it'll be given to people don't have a choice, and we would accept that.
Yeah, I don't think very many people would argue about implanting child molesters, do you?
No, not at all.
Right, so that's how you start down the path, and then you gradually extend it, and then there are those benefits, like you wave your arm to pay and all that sort of thing. And people will buy into that, but one day down the line, you turn back and you look and you say all of a sudden, The government knows where you are all the time, and what happens when you're dealing with a government that's not as benign as the current one? This is the question you have to ask yourself over and over again when looking at these technologies, not what the current government will do, because the current government has good motives. We may not all agree on the methods and the choices and the way things are being done specifically, but I think we all agree that the motives are good. They're trying to do what they think.
Well,
is best for
we
the
hope they are. There's some who believe that though some in office may be good, some others in office may not be. You're as good as who you're surrounded by. And
I'm talking more in terms of at the institutional level.
Okay.
There's certainly going to be individual politicians as we've seen that are crumbs. But that's today. That's today's government.
That professor you're talking about, I think, was Professor Dan Solove. That might have been him.
Could be.
He's the gummy bear guy.
Yeah, I just love the gummy bear part. It's too bad he moved beyond those because I love that gummy bear image. but anyway, it's today's government though that we're not worrying about per se when it comes to these technologies. It's tomorrow's government. What happens when one day down the line there's an administration that you don't agree with? It's going to happen sooner or later. Or a truly evil administration 10 years down the line.
Because we'll always have administrations that 50% of the American population won't agree with.
Yeah, but 50% isn't the problem. The problem is what happens when you have someone who is truly a dictator,
evil.
For example.
Yeah, it's
truly
the evil.
Truly a dictator, the equivalent of Saddam Hussein in the United States, but with the kind of technological capability that we're putting in place right now.
True.
Now, some people would argue that couldn't happen. But I think that there are factors that make all these kinds of things possible. Now, for example, if there's another terrorist attack in this country.
Oh, heaven help us. For everything, for rights, you name it. You're absolutely right. I know where you're headed with this.
Yeah. One attack, potentially much larger than 9/11. It's certainly the kinds of scenarios that have been drawn out could be much larger.
If a radiological bomb goes off.
Yeah, and there's a strong possibility that basically all the rights would go out the window at once. And I think a lot of people would buy into that. And maybe that's their choice. I think that's one way to look at it, is to say, look, if you feel that this is the way you want to take the country in terms of saving life, as the most important thing, and I think we all agree that has to be at the top of the list, because if you're dead, you can't do anything.
Well, then, right? I've got to ask you, Lauren, the horrible question, and that is, if we all agree that if the next horrible attack will basically allow all of us to say, do whatever you have to do, take our rights away, how sure then can we be as a country that attack was indeed a real attack? And I've got to ask you that only because you got to look at the motives behind it then. It sure would be convenient, wouldn't it, to whittle away all your rights and get the sympathy of the population with something that happens?
I wonder if it really matters at that point, because you would end up in the same place either way, I think. Whether it was a real attack or a false attack, the result would still be people who were dead, and the result would still be most people, probably including you and me, screaming bloody murder.
I think there's a difference, because if it's a false attack, and nobody's saying it is or will be, but you do got to think about that. If it's a false attack, then we've lost our country, and we need to take that back. If it's a real terrorist attack, then the war continues and the attacks occur and we attack and that continues. But if it's a false attack, I think we have a bigger problem than a real attack. I really do.
Oh, I agree. I agree there's a bigger problem. I'm just sort of thinking about this and saying, as a practical matter, at the end of the day, Does it change? Do you have any more options one way or the other? Because the odds are it would be very hard to know what had actually happened.
No, you don't have the options. I don't think. I mean, well, let me ask you this. If there's another horrible attack, do we have to lose our rights in order to combat it?
The answer is no, but, and it's a gigantic but in blinking red letters, we probably will. Unfortunately, this is one of those situations where I'm extremely pessimistic, and I think that it is very likely that we are going to be going down this path where privacy becomes archaic and all that. And I don't think we're necessarily going to be able to stop it. We can try to bring some sanity to the process. We can try to bring some balance. We can try to prevent decisions being made in a haphazard way. But I think the trend of history and, you know, meshing with technology the way it is now paints a very dark picture, because we all want to stop terrorists, and we are living in a world now where terrorism is a very real problem. Perhaps the only hope, however small it might be, is to try to find ways to change the structure of the relationships on this planet and between the countries, to try to snuff out terrorism at its source rather than having to deal with it on a case-by-case basis after horrible things happen.
So you're saying, though, that regardless of how it occurs, it looks like we'll lose our rights. And that means those people who want them have won, whether you call it the Illuminati or the group that wants a one-world government, whatever it is, they've won, haven't they?
In that scenario, yeah. And that's not saying good. It's not saying bad. It's just saying that's the reality. I mean, the reality is that we are moving in a direction where these kinds of rights that you and I are talking about are increasingly being considered to be superfluous by more and more people. And in a sufficiently horrible situation, you're going to get, you know, 100% people agreeing that it's superfluous and it's not something you can afford to have. We're not there yet, but if we continue to operate on a basis of trying to deal with individual cases rather than trying to figure out why terrorists are out there and trying to do something to prevent them from creating ever more terrorists, churning them out of the terrorism machine, then we are going to go pretty much inevitably down that path that we're talking about. And so that's sort of where our choices are.
But it's going to have to be a big one, right?
It's going to require a change that goes beyond the technology and goes beyond privacy. It goes way beyond our pay grade, if you know what I mean.
I understand.
It has to be done by the people who really have the power and are willing to say, hey, you know, maybe we do have to look beyond 5 years. Maybe we do have to give up a little bit in terms of power, in terms of various economic issues and things, to try to balance this out and just wash out the fires that are causing terrorism. But if we're just going to try to stop individual terrorists at airports with bomb detectors, I don't think in the long run that's going to solve our problem.
All right, Lauren, stay with us, because next hour we'll take phone calls for you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.